Right, so before we go any further, I just want to find out a show of hands. We're going to do a slightly different format here. Have we got questions from the audience? I want to see how interactive you're going to be. Oh, there we go. Right, so what I am going to do then is I will default to questions from my side, but engage you early on rather than waiting for a 20-minute at the last stage of this discussion. Charles, I think we're going to have to hear from you at this juncture, given the base case that has been set, the utopia that has been described by Stafford. Is Bitcoin the solution to all the world's ills?
No. But it's a bloody good start. And I think, you know, the optimism that Stafford so eloquently expresses could be a reality. The kind of conundrum for me is that its biggest friction point is the one that he's already highlighted, is that people don't understand it. Until they understand it, they won't adopt it, and then that future will never kind of materialize. It'll only materialize for a very small group of people who bothered to understand it. If you like, the evangelists or the purists or the, what do you call yourself, a maxi, Bitcoin maxis.
So I think you called me that. I don't call
me that. And the generations that are refusing to kind of understand it are the ones that are in this room and mostly on the stage as well. And so what we see practically, and we've got Easy Crypto as one of our businesses, and so we sell crypto. We see the age, the difference between those who get it and those who don't. And it's stark, you know. So if you're a 55-year-old white male, you're buying no crypto. But if you're a 25-year-old South African of any gender, you're buying lots of it. 25 to 30% of their portfolios. In fact, on our platforms as of March, 27% of all volume across our platform is now crypto. And you're competing.
Wait. So that's a major one. So say that stat again.
27% of all flows on our platform.
All flows.
That's competing with the biggest and best asset classes, the oldest asset classes in the world. And we don't just, it's not just about competing with South African equities. We've got US equities, UK equities, Australian equities, European equities, South African equities. We've got ETFs that cover the world. And this little crypto universe dominates 27% of all of our flow. The demographic supporting that, average age of a crypto owner is 29 years old, and they're everyday South African. So they get it. And so the future, the difference, you know, what I disagree with is I think the future is imminent, but it's going to be owned by these 29-year-olds who've adopted it. And our generation is going to largely be left behind or not adopt it. And so I think the future will come slower than the Bitcoin evangelists or maximalists.
Can I respond?
No, I want to... I'm the boss on the stage here. You can respond in a moment, but first thing I want to challenge you on, Stafford, is that you rubbish all the other coins. So the Doges, the Cardano's, etc., Ethereum. Yeah. It's only Bitcoin in your life.
So I don't rubbish them. Okay, let me be very, very clear. You can be a Bitcoin maxi like I am without... There's a book called Read, Write, Own. Right, and that book just came out very recently. It's written by Chris Dixon. Go get that book. If you want to go put your money into ETH and Solana, Cardano, and Purple Coin, and Pink Coins, and Yellow Coins, go do it. Right? That's okay. But understand that they are solving for something different. You know, Solana wants to be the fastest. Ethereum wants to be the world's biggest computer. Those things are interesting. And from a computer science perspective, very interesting. But don't bring them into the Bitcoin realm because they don't belong there. Neither does Bitcoin belong in that realm, right? So it's solving for a completely different use case. Remember, with the way blockchains work, it's a triangle, and I've put that triangle up. You can only have two of the three. And the triangle points are decentralization, scale, and security. Pick your two, right? So you're either going to be super secure and then decentralized like Bitcoin, but you're going to suffer from scale. Right? Block size, you know, every 10 minutes only, slow transaction speeds, etc. But we know the answer there about a layer two and all that. I won't go there. But, oh, you go to Solana. Solana scales. It's fast. You know, They're secure and they're fast, but they can't get decentralized. So they're centralized. So they're solving for a completely different problem. I think the reason I focus so heavily on Bitcoin is because of the stack.
Understood. Do you own anything other than Bitcoin?
I used to. My journey was very similar to lots of people's journey, right? It took me 2 years to get Bitcoin. Remember my background before I came into Bitcoin? I had a startup called Thumbs Up and we were doing card payments. So I built a machine, a little device that plugged into a phone that converted a phone into a card acceptance machine, right? I built that hardware. We invented, we had patents associated with it. We integrated with banks. We looked at the money flow from a card and how it switches and the crypto that happens there and how a bank works and operates. I came from that world. When someone showed me Bitcoin, my first thing was like, it's bullshit, right? Because I knew how fiat worked. And then when I got into it, I loved it. And I thought, wait, I like it. Like, I like these other coins because they're fun, right? And then when I got
into it. Stafford, you've answered my question there and I've given you okay. latitude.
Yeah.
Charles, I want to understand your portfolio in the crypto space.
Yeah, I just think that, I mean, Bitcoin is the best representation of money we've ever seen. But does that make it the best representation of money ever? And the answer to that for me is, I'm not. You know, fiat could never have imagined, described, or predicted Bitcoin. And so then the next generation of money, we can't describe either or picture. But it is by far, the best representation of money we've ever seen. And so certainly for our lives, I think it'll play that role. It's going to be the best representation of money. And what does it mean about money? Really, for me, it's about a store of value that you can trust and that is secure. Those are the key things that it does really well. It does everything else really badly. And blockchain and the technology that can do so much more than just be a store of value or a trusted mechanism for exchange. And so I think personally that the opportunity that has existed for the early Bitcoin holders, where did you buy your first Bitcoin?
I think it was 2015.
And what was the value?
I bought at 9K, I think.
Cool. So that
7,000 or 9,000.
So 10X almost.
Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, I mean, there were no asset managers to defend themselves, but any asset manager who bought Nvidia in the last year has outperformed Bitcoin. So
not anymore.
So I can see how this conversation. Yeah. You got a final point to make? Because I know there are many members of the audience wanting
to. Just the point, the last, just to close that after, is that inside all of those other coins, I think there are investment opportunities that are just as good as Bitcoin was. So from an investment perspective, there are excellent investment opportunities outside of Bitcoin. But I agree with Stafford is that there's no one challenging Bitcoin for the best store of value. And I don't think there is room. There isn't, like, there's only one gold, and silver and platinum have never rivaled gold. Bitcoin is that representation. But there's great investment opportunities and technology and minds being applied to creating utility out of blockchain coins, not blockchain coins, but out of tokens that have got different utility to Bitcoin, and in my mind, solve bigger problems.
And I want to drive into the finite supply of Bitcoin, the 21 million out there, only 2 million or so still to mine. But, sir, I'm coming to you. We'll talk about that in a moment.
You said pale males are 55. I'm a pale male and I'm 70. I'm a financial planner. I'm a chartered accountant. I look at Bitcoin at the moment. Instead of getting my clients to sign the fact that they understand what they're investing, I'm getting a letter to my clients to say, I've told you about Bitcoin and you refuse to get it. Because I believe that if I haven't done that, I'm going to be negligent. And that's the position I'm taking right now.
Yeah, you and well done. I mean, you're in the minority. And we've got... I should have brought the data, but I think our oldest Bitcoin holder is 91 years old. So, I'm 50, so I'm not far, I'm 55. But the point is, we're in the minority, and we represent, so Easy Equities represents 1 million customers. And so our demographic data is going to be very representative of the country. 1 million's a good sample set. But the key really is that the adoption at a 55-year-old will be a couple of percent. And frankly, it's not going to move the needle on anything. A percent 10xing is 10%. It's not going to move the needle for any of that generation. Whereas a 29-year-old who's investing 25 to 30% and getting a 10x return, I mean, we're watching millionaires emerge who started a journey of investing 5 years ago.
You know, I look at our client base, you go, the guy's 29 and he's a millionaire and he earns 20,000 rand a month. How did that happen? And it happened because he's been buying Bitcoin for 5 years. And so they are outweighing and their investments towards things like crypto. And it's not exclusive, and that's where it's not just Bitcoin. 60% of the volumes are Bitcoin, 40% are all other coins. And interestingly, that's exactly what the advice I would have given them and I didn't give them, is like 60% Bitcoin, 40% everything else. And in fact, that's my investment advice for anything. If you're building a solid portfolio, I'd be 60% passive, 40% active. High conviction in your 40% stuff and you know, lower conviction in your 60%.
I think it's a beautiful statement. I think you're echoing what I kind of opened up with. And that's such a beautiful thing to hear, because there's the real world statistics. It's not just a slide. But what's beautiful about Bitcoin is it's the first IPO that I've seen where the institutions are coming after the fact. Right? You and I, the 29-year-olds, could all buy a stake in this thing. And now we're getting the rails called ETFs. We're now getting the FASB verbiage so you can hold it on a balance sheet. So what we see happening is the institutions are coming after the fact. And that's such a turn on the model that we used to, where we're IPOing and it's Morgan Stanley and there's pre-IPO activity, and then you and I get to buy the shares, you know, when it finally lists. So it's such a different model. So it's interesting.
As you say, when Larry Fink comes around, yep, exactly. Take note. What I am going to do here, because I'm also sensing, and gentlemen, you're going to have to work with me because I'm reading the room and there are lots of questions. So I think what we'll do is take a couple of questions at the same time. Just show me where the mic is right now, please. Who else around this gentleman has questions? Right. So we're going to take those three. Sir, I've noted you in the front. Promise. Okay. So let's go with it. Can we get your question? And then we're going to pass it down. Gentlemen, you're going to wait until all three questions have been asked. Thank you.
Morning. So my question is around the traditional investment thesis is to not have all your eggs in one basket. So in terms of talking about Bitcoin, what's the struggle I found, and I'm sure some people can say the same, is you want to invest in Bitcoin, and I have, but to what extent do you make it the majority of your portfolio or the minority? And how do you sort of gauge that? Because there's obviously other things you can invest in, stocks, gold. Some people are saying Bitcoin is like gold, but it's a very tricky one to figure out because you want to invest in it, but how much of your cash are you willing to actually put into it?
Right. As the mic's going down, you can diversification. Let's go with
cool. It's a great question. And really, it's about your evaluation of your investment choices and what your expectations are of those choices, and outweigh your allocation to the choices that you think have got the highest propensity to grow. So if you just take, let's just take two choices, right? I live in Joburg. And if my only choices were buy Bitcoin or Joburg property, I'd be 100% Bitcoin, because Joburg property has done nothing for...
I think you may be with everybody else.
For everyone else. So that choice is, easy. It's obviously an easy choice. But if you're now evaluating, let's say, NVIDIA as a good topic versus Bitcoin, you're no longer 100, you know, to one. You're now probably going, sure, you know, that's maybe I'm 50-50 on NVIDIA, which is an AI play fundamentally. So you're AI now against Bitcoin. And so you've got to go through a process where all of your investment choices, you've ranked them on their propensity to give you a return over your return period, and then weight those in. And the key thing is it's not less, it should never be one, right? There should never be one choice, and there mustn't be more than 20. And the kind of magic is in the middle of those two numbers. So you should have at least 10 investment opportunities that you're reviewing, and your expectation of return of them, you must be clear and honest with yourself, and then weight that expectation and then see how that outcome delivers, and check in on it all the time. And it's okay to change your mind, and it's okay to upweight and downweight different assets, but that's how you've got to do it. And you know, the asset manager...
Sorry, Charles, we've got half an hour left and I've got so many questions.
Quickly address that. Yes. I think just quickly relative to you, go do more work. Go read more. Okay, stop listening to us on the stage. Read more. The more you read, the more you comprehend what this thing is, what this market looks like, etc. Too many of guys your age, and you look young, too many guys in your age want to either, the question comes up, can I trade it? Should I trade it? I've learned that I'm a very bad trader. I suck at trading. I lost a lot of money in trading in the 2002, 2003.
You're not alone. 80% of people lose their money.
Yeah, yeah. I day traded and I lost a lot of my money. So I realized that I'm not a good trader. And I started working on the market. That's why ETFs, you know, low-cost ETFs are, like, if you're young, your age, etc. So you need to ask yourself, do you want to play? Then take your play coins and go play. If you want to invest and you want your store value to grow consistently between now and when you're my age, when you hit 50, you know, then there's only one choice in my view, and go play. But before you go listen to this, go read the Bitcoin Standard. Go read, listen to podcasts, get deep involved. When you truly comprehend
it. Gentlemen are making it very difficult for me. Okay. Right. Now I'm going to have to start being aggressive, and I hate being aggressive. Go ahead.
Thank you. This is for Stafford. Thanks for some great talks there. Could you speak a bit to the legislative risks for cryptocurrencies in general, for central banks worldwide, as well as to AI tokens, which I think is something quite topical as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I take the next question before we answer that, please? Thank you.
Thanks, guys. It's been great. Both of you really, mine's more practical around hard wallets, soft wallets. I know your feeling from the law business for
is
more hard. What new tech are we seeing? So we're seeing we've got an awesome asset, store of value and so on. What new tech are we seeing in the hard wallets, soft wallets, and what would you advise?
And one more.
Testing, testing.
This is for you, Stafford.
Okay.
If I may use the technology from a 63-year-old pale male, and I see the majority of us would have children in this room.
Yeah.
What happens to Bitcoin? All the electricity gets shut down everywhere on Earth for 10 years.
Right, so we're now going to start taking, let's start with the legislative side of things.
Okay, I'll start with the easy one. If all electricity in the world gets shut off, you don't have Bitcoin issues.
The lights are out.
You've got other issues. I mean, and that's and if you understand Bitcoin's energy participation and its role, it will potentially mitigate that from happening. If you truly understand, that's why I say go do some work on understanding Bitcoin mining and how it works, because then you'll actually see that it keeps the lights on longer. And that whole notion of it wastes energy, it uses too much energy. I heard Alex said something about that today. You didn't do the work. You don't understand it. If you really, really, truly comprehend it, then you'll understand how it plays within the energy environment very congruently. Renewables, ECG, ESG, all of those things. Yeah.
I think we're going to pause on that one. I want to talk about the legislative issues. And Charles, I want you to weigh in here because regulation, we've just seen it actually in Nigeria. Yeah. They've actually shut down one of the exchanges completely because of the falling Naira. I'm not sure if any of you...
We're seeing it play out in American politics today. You know, so Biden anti-crypto, Bitcoin specifically, and Trump for it. So it's now, for the first time ever, it's in a political agenda and a vote swinger. And so it's going to, and that's going to play out more and more. Americans always kind of lead with this. And this is one of... There are a couple of things about Bitcoin that are oxymorons. The fact that we have to store it in a bank vault kills me, because the other one is that it is politically influenced. You know, and so it likes to be this non-political instrument that cannot be influenced by politics, but it's 100% influenced by politics right now, because power is state owned, and so they could tax us, and then if they tax us, they influence the price if they make it more difficult to mine. And so Bitcoin is not immune from politics, which is also legislation is a way of taxing Bitcoin. And so it is going to be critical to see how that plays out. And so, to bring that back to South Africa, in South Africa, the legislation doesn't recognize it as a financial instrument. It has said that they are going to propagate legislation that takes it there. And so it's going to be treated as a financial instrument, hopefully very soon. And when it is, it'll be treated like every other financial instrument, will be regulated in the very same way. And if you want to know what a regulated market looks like, that's exactly the U.S. You know, the U.S. is a highly regulated market. They treat Bitcoin like every other store of value and asset. The difference, I think, with this financial instrument is it threatens the central bank. It threatens government's currency. And so there could be political interference through legislation which disrupts its utility in a way that creates a political weapon of it. And it's a political weapon right now as we speak.
Stefan, I want you to input on that before we go to Neil's question on the hardware side of things.
So first of all, here's my view. I'll give you my macro view and we'll kind of chisel it down. I believe that central banks will acquire Bitcoin to back the currency.
When?
Okay, within the next... El Salvador has done it, you know, already as a country. El Salvador will be paying off its IMF debt when Bitcoin hits $100,000 this year. The first time in history, a country like that will pay off its debt because of Bitcoin. So
I think Charles is asking you when mainstream. And remember, it's a trick question because you put a date out there next time you stand up at this Biz News conference, people are going to hold you to it.
Guess what? I've always been wrong because it always beats me. when will central bank? So here's how it will work. Today, ETFs allow for a regulatory highway and a set of APIs that takes the friction away from acquiring this asset class, right? So you can pick up the phone and call Larry Fink's desk and say, I want to put $10 billion into this thing. So that's the first legislative round. We've already had it. It looks like digital property, capital gains tax, the tax man, etc. ETFs have come along and built this kind of framework around it. Now you can own it. How you treat it from a taxation perspective, it depends on which jurisdiction. So we're seeing governments being friendly towards it. I think that expands out. You know, shortly a year after, we will see through the FASB rules. So the FASB rules were issued November, December last year. And those FASB rules are very interesting because now we have the taxonomy that allows an organization to have this on their balance sheet as an asset. So when it goes up, they get the benefit. When it goes down, they can do the write-offs, et cetera. So it's a beautiful thing. So that's come along. That's going to be big, really big. What comes along year after this year is Apple, Google, Microsoft. They're all sitting, instead of doing stock buybacks, my prediction is they'll buy Bitcoin. Okay. Now, again, there's a prediction. You can write it somewhere. They will buy Bitcoin. Soon thereafterwards, we will see countries lending against it. Before we get there, banks will. I sit on the board of a bank. Okay, I'm telling you now, you know, the treasury assets of banks won't be going and buying bonds and government bonds and treasuries, etc. They are going to start leaning over and looking at this asset class and saying, why not? Banks will start buying and lending against Bitcoin. When? My opinion, you'll start seeing that in the next 24 months. In the next 36 months, you will see sovereign wealth funds. You will see countries, central banks leaning in here. I believe Bitcoin will save the US dollar.
And that's a bold, I think, on that statement. We're going to, Neil, you spoke about the previous Biz News conference, about the hardware and new tech hardware, Stafford.
Yeah, that's an easy one. So look, I mean, it's three layers here. You got layer one, and this is Bitcoin, slow, big, you know, store value, etc. Layer two is where you get the speed. And that's where Lightning lives, right? That's peer-to-peer, that's scale. That gives you a hyperscale. There's a lot that's happening in there too. Where does it go? Where does the technology go? What's really interesting for me from a Bitcoin perspective now is identity and authentication. That's a global challenge right now. You know, who Facebook knows you is not recognized anywhere else. How Google understands who you are is not recognized everywhere outside of a particular technology domain. Your South African ID identity is, I think, layer two. It's an interesting world where you're going to start seeing not just peer-to-peer money movement at scale with Lightning. And take a look at Lightning now. I mean, the liquidity on Lightning is incredible. The amount of movement there. Again, we don't bring that into the equation. We just talked about Bitcoin alone, but you can't. Lightning. So layer two, I think that expands into identity. When it expands into identity, that's when the utility and the application goes through the roof. That's when you can authenticate going into a country. That's when you can truly verify who you are, you know, transversally. That's a big business challenge. Global challenge. Layer three is what you're talking about. That's where the wallets live, right? So that's your MetaMasks, those are your soft wallets, and etc. There's a lot of froth there. You know, putting NFTs in it with your Bitcoin, with your ETH. That's interesting. You get Ledger where you can take it off and hard, soft, cold. It depends on your philosophy and your appetite for risk. I mean, there's a lot of innovation on that level, and it's moving at 1,000 miles an hour. It slows down when you come down, all the way down to Bitcoin. But on the top, yeah, I mean, I could sit you all there and tell you what I think is coming. But the big one to focus on, in my opinion, with these wallets, soft, hard, cold, and layer two, is authentication and repudiation. Right. And that's going to be the big next utility.
So I know you're going to get it. The mic is there at the moment. But before we, just give me a show of hands, how many questions I still have in the audience? All right, good. So let's go with yours, please. And if we can just pass it down to this gentleman next.
Just a quick question for Charles. I mean, obviously, you guys are doing great work in facilitating the buying and selling of the asset class in a user-friendly platform. But is the business doing something more fundamental, whether it's in your treasury or otherwise, to be more fundamentally exposed to the asset class?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Okay, wait, Charles, sorry. No, sorry. Go ahead with your question. And just to, we've 15 minutes, so that's why I'm starting to sound a little short.
Just by the way, yes, you were worried about the amount of questions.
I plan for any scenario, and what's happening here is we're talking to the audience. They're the most important thing in this room. Right, go ahead.
Cool, thanks guys. I just think, you know, the early days of Bitcoin, it had a number of times where it could have been taken out, but yeah, the altruism in the environment and the early adoption of Bitcoin really set it apart to actually get to the volume and capacity that it has now, the hardest money in the history of the world, as you both said. The altcoin world is often about transferring wealth from users to founders. How do you, with very little to no altruism involved, how do you offer those kind of platforms, those kind of tokens on a long-term investment basis to clients and protect them from bad actors in the altcoin universe?
Thank you. Thank you. And if I can get the mic to this gentleman here in the front. Thank you very much.
Can I start answering?
You can start out, sir. Oh, I like this. Very well
behaved. So as CEO of a listed company, it's not my job to make money holding Bitcoin. You know, it's and if I was an asset manager, that would be my job. And so I can't see a future within the next 2 or 3 years where I swap rands for Bitcoin, unless we end up in a political environment where the rand, you know, we have a Venezuela, in which case I'll have no choice. But it isn't my job, and I don't think it's Apple's job either. We've got businesses to run, and we must maximize our profitability based on the businesses that we run, products that we create. Asset managers must do. And if we want to outsource, if we've got too much cash in our balance sheet, either give it back to your investors and let them buy Bitcoin, or invest it in your business. So I don't see companies holding Bitcoin other than as a treasury function to facilitate transactions. Like I hold rands or dollars on my balance sheet because customers are giving me rands and dollars. So there's a treasury function.
I need to ask you, so what do you think about what MicroStrategy is doing right now?
Yeah.
With Bitcoin?
Yeah, that's kind of their business.
No, their software business.
I know, but it's kind of, they've taken the decision, and obviously at a board level and a strategic level, that it is part of their business. What I'm saying, it isn't part of my business. You know, and my decision is, I think that crypto is going to be a lasting part of the financial ecosystem. So what did we do? We went and bought Easy Crypto. It was a startup started by Michael Jordan. So we're always going to be in the space. And so I always see it as a lasting part of my ecosystem, but it's not my job to own Bitcoin. So that's how, you know, that's dealing with that. In terms of protecting customers, you know, these altcoins, if you like, that are just fake. How's that different from anything else? Like somebody starts a company, it's about transferring wealth to the founders. And sometimes products are good and sometimes products are bad. But investor, beware. You've got to do your own research. You've got to read the material.
And I think on that note, yesterday, anybody who was with us inside Jacobson's session, Tesla is a fraud waiting to, he didn't say blow up, but shorten the thing.
Yeah. Look, that's been the worst short in history.
I'm going to go to this gentleman, sir.
First of all, Stafford, thank you so much for your contribution to the Business News Tribe and how you've educated me personally, and I think the rest of us. And to Charles, also your contribution as well. The question is, I know right now I can go to Pick and Pay and use my Luno wallet to then buy services or goods. When do you see me buying a Toyota one day in South Africa with the same process?
It's interesting. I mean, I get this question a lot, and it goes towards its broader utility. You know, will we start buying, our Starbucks with this? What I want you to think about from Bitcoin is, it's like, Michael Saylor said it so well the past 10 days or so. He said it better than anyone else. He said, you got to think about it as digital property first. Okay, it's digital property. It's gold and property. You don't take your mortgage and your bank card linked to your mortgage and go buy your Starbucks with that. You don't buy a Starbucks with a building, the value or the assets associated with your building, right? So that's how you've got to almost think about it today. That's Bitcoin. Bitcoin is not built for that today.
It's got technologies on top of it. It's layer two technologies. That's the Lightning Network, where you can have a wallet that comes from layer three, where you can put some of your Bitcoin in it and you can exchange value for it. What's very, very interesting for me is not the medium of exchange where you're buying a Coke with it or you're buying a burger with it. For me, what's more interesting is when people start utilizing the protocol as an arbitrage network, or versus the SWIFT network, or versus the Visa network, where you are passing rands through Bitcoin on Lightning into pounds. There's a company that's doing it right now called Strike. So they're utilizing the Bitcoin as a bearer instrument for inter-fiat protocol exchange, because it does it so well, it does it so fast, the liquidity is there, and the utility of that is extraordinary from a remittance perspective through to a global settlement perspective, and ultimately through buying the Coke to it in the long tail. That's very, very interesting for me, and that's where I'm focusing a lot of my energy at the moment and investigating it, is how can we utilize this as a protocol for inter-fiat interchange. And Strike is a company that's doing it today. I just don't understand the commercials, but I like the model. The ability for you to send Naira from dollars in seconds and settle. There's never before in the history of humanity have we been able to convey value at this velocity globally. We've never been able to do it. We don't fully comprehend it.
Just remember that the Nigerian government has, as I said, just kicked the crypto space out of the regulatory fold in Nigeria because of the falling Naira.
Yeah. I mean, to your question, very soon you'll be able to do that. And what's going to be the catalyst? They'll regulate it as a financial instrument. Banks will give you the ability to have a Bitcoin wallet, and you'll be able to transact on your card and say, you want to use your rands, your dollars, or your Bitcoin. As soon as they legislate it, the banks are ready. All of the banks are ready to deliver crypto wallets to their customers once it gets legislated. Some of them have been brave enough. We partnered with Capitec to allow crypto within their ecosystem. So the Capitec customers can buy crypto on our rails. Other banks are waiting for legislation to be more firm. So very soon, it's not a good utility for it. And this is why I just go back to that balance sheet point. It's not a good utilization of your balance sheet if you have an instrument that is as volatile as Bitcoin remains. Because your earnings, you're going to report earnings and your balance sheet is going to obfuscate with the good work you're doing, because Bitcoin went down 30%. And so it's too volatile to be a good transactional mechanism. It's a good store of value over the long term. It's a dreadful store of value potentially over the very short term. And so it's not a good transactional currency. Not yet.
100%.
Warren?
Guys, thanks. Just some comments around custody and legacy issues with the coin. So what is the best way to own it? How do you leave it to your kids, as an example? How do you, and is the law settled on, the legacy of how to best own this? So, for example, how do you put in your will or in your trust deed how to own it? And what is the best mechanism that solves the best mechanism for ownership that solves those legacy issues?
Yeah, can I give one example?
Yeah.
Yesterday, we were out here. And a guy came up to me, he was introduced to me. You did. Yeah, you gave me the example about this. He's the best example ever, because that's a real world example. He's got somebody that put his kids, he had a will. His kids moved to Australia. I hope I get the story right. His kids moved to Australia. He died or something happened, right? His kids obviously became citizens there, etc. For them to gain assets within the world, they had to come back to South Africa, re-register. It was a nightmare. So you know what they did? They drew all the assets out, put into Bitcoin, and sent it to the kids in Australia. And then they called and shut down the whole thing inside because they said, just don't worry about it, we're not coming back.
His question's different.
His question is different, but I just wanted to give you an example. The question, but here's a very real example of how people are utilizing this asset relative to that. Now, is that like legislatively right? Is avoiding some? No, but it's a very good example. So how do you store the stuff? How do you put it in walls, etc.? It all depends, right? So I believe in taking it off chain. So so you take your Bitcoin and you put it onto a Ledger stick. You put it onto some stamped piece of steel. You write down your passphrases. There's if you go Google how to, and then you give certain people aspects to it.
You got to be real responsible with it. And then you put it somewhere in a vault and it gets kept there.
Or you could just let us manage it.
Or you just let...
So we do all of that for you. Yeah. So we cold store it. We put it in bank vaults, literally bank vaults at Absa. There are 5 executives that have the keys to those. Can, you know, 2 have to pitch up fingerprints and take it out the vault. We keep 10% of your assets on ledger to create liquidity, but 90% are sitting in bank vaults. And then we store it in a nominee company in your name. And so your will just has to nominate where that asset goes. But we've got the asset. Why do we do that? Because we could never... We would never want to suffer the trust impact of losing your Bitcoin. So we do it the safest possible way you can do it. And that's the way I can sleep at night, is to put it in that far away. And it's an anomaly for me because it's this digital currency that has to live in bank vaults with no digital access. At some point, I think they'll solve the security, maybe. But for now, it is a very unsecure mechanism. The store of value is very unsecure if you keep it on ledger.
So we've got 5 minutes left. Can I just see if we've catered for everybody in the audience? Are there? Yes, sir. Another question here. Any and there. Great.
So I want to come back, Bronwyn, to the issue of what is money. So we agree. It's a unit of exchange, a unit of measure, and a store of wealth. And that's really the issue that I battle to understand. Anything that can go from $10 to $20,000 and crash to $3,000 when the whales decide to dump and just push the price down, and they make all the bucks, and the poor suckers who bought in there are devastated, and many of them cash in. Because every investment, well, there's a winner, there's a loser. And so, you know, from going down to, where did it go again? Let me just check. It went from 20,000 down to 3,000, then up to 60,000, then bang, down to 20,000 again. Now it's up at 73,000. We're having a magnificent roller coaster ride. And as much as I want to make that money, I also realize there's huge risk. And I have to say, this is a speculation and not an investment, because anything that's roller coaster is not a store of wealth. And I must be prepared to lose everything.
I'm going to go, gentleman at the back there, and then my lady in the second.
Sorry, Ari, rather than a question, I want to answer the gentleman in front of me. Well, what's the difference with the rand? Go back 25 years. What was the rand then? Look, I'd say it basically depreciates by 7 to 8% per annum over the last 20 years. It's also very speculative.
I'm going to go with your question there, please.
Thank you. By the way, just a quick while the mic gets past, whales influencing the price, those days are gone now. Eh? Very gone. I mean, look at how much iBit owns 300 something thousand BTC right now, coins. I mean, it's 2.5 to 3%.
Also, I think we haven't talked about the impact of the ETFs. And so your question, I mean, there's validity in what you're saying in the sense it's too volatile. The market isn't mature enough yet for everyone, you know, and just looking at you, I can tell you that it's, you know, your risk profile, your age, to put everything into Bitcoin would be a stupid decision, in my view, as your store of value. But the ETF changes everything. And I just want to describe why, because I think it's really simple. The demand that the ETF has created is 10,000 coins a day. Currently, we're printing 900 a day, and that's going to halve to 450 on around about.
We don't print, we issue.
We issue. Same thing.
Same
thing. Digital printing. That's going to go down to 450. The demand is, this is the minimum demand we're going to see from the ETF. This is not, it was actually very disappointing the start, just when it listed December, January. It's picked up nicely February and March. And in my view, this is the least demand we're going to see for the next decade.
Love that.
And so you've got the supply-demand issue, which is going to support greater liquidity and price. And so you're going to see a much more stable asset, in my view, in the future, near future, over this next decade. The next wave of liquidity is going to be when 401k pension fund holders start buying Bitcoin. And they don't have to buy a lot. This is the misnomer. This is not about people buying 100% of their portfolio.
1 or 2%.
They just need to buy 1 or 2%. And everyone is going to get off zero. I promise you now. It is going to be in every single U.S. citizen's pension fund over the next decade.
Can I share some numbers? Let me share some numbers. So the February inflows were 117,000 BTC was purchased. Okay? That was 5 billion went in. In March, it's trending right now. We're going to probably have 153,000 BTC sold. So 10 billion inflows. So together, that was 270,000 BTC that was bought in the last 60 days. It was 15 billion. very likely we get another 100 billion for the rest of the year. That's just the next 9 months. At a 70 multiple, 7 trillion added to its market cap. Right? That equals 420,000 a coin by the end of the year. That's conservatively what's being stated. Now, I don't say invest on the basis of these numbers, but what he's saying is 1,000% correct. These inflows that you're seeing now are steady. They're conservative. It's not roadshow based yet. You're not seeing 401ks cascading into it yet. This is just a prelim.
Right. Right. We've got 2 minutes left. Gail, you've got the concluding question. And gentlemen, between you,
yes,
you have got 1 minute 30 to answer before I bring
Sean. Let's start the show first.
Gail.
Be nice. Be nice.
As a CA, what I'm being asked by my clients...
As a CA.
Yeah, okay. In terms of current legislation, which governs things like contracts, liquidations, insolvencies, marriages, divorces, how do you deal with a business partner or an ex-spouse when their assets are held in an untraceable hard wallet?
Well, I mean, so
with difficulty.
Gail, that's a million-dollar question as the last one. I want to hear both of these gentlemen talking about it.
It isn't untraceable.
It's not untraceable at all. It's the most traceable. Bitcoin is the most open ledger in the entire world. It's actually, if you don't want to, that's what people say, like, this is where you put fraud and you sell, like, kiddie porn and stuff. This is not what you do it with. Ransomware, yeah, sure. But, I mean, we're talking about less than 2% of this entire asset class is utilized for that because it is open. Because you can go and trace back every transaction in the ledger forever. It's the FBI's, CIA's best tool ever. Mm. So no, you can go back. You can trace it back. There's a million ways to do it. And I'm very happy to speak to you about, like, how do you do that? I mean, you can use a company like this to do it. They will be able to.
We do trace it.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had lots of customers who store their own wallets and then they get defrauded and then we'd help them trace what actually happened. It doesn't mean you're going to get it back, but you'll know who the perpetrator is. Because
on that note, Stafford Marcy and Charles Savage, thank you very much, gentlemen, for your time.
Thank you.